So John 18:28. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If you were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. This took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him. It is your custom for me to release one prisoner at the time of Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him with a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and slapped him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I'm bringing out to you to let you know that I found no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and the officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate answered, "Take him and crucify him. You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid and went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" said Pilate. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given you from above. Therefore, the one that handed you over to you is guilty of a greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free. But the Jewish leaders kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at the place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabgatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
Well, thank you very much, Hannah, and thank you for having me back to speak to you on the next bit of John's Gospel. It'd be a great help for me and for you if you could keep that passage out in front of you. And also on the page, you'll see that there's an outline for where we're going to go over the next 20 minutes or so. We're continuing our series called Why Care About Easter, where we're considering the significance of Jesus' death. I want to persuade us that Jesus' death has deeply significant implications for each and every one of us. Whoever you pick out in the city, or the world for that matter, Jesus' death has deeply significant implications for them. But obviously that's not widely recognised. What are we, say 40, 50 people? In a city, in a square mile that is reported to be 300,000 people, most of those people not given a second thought to Jesus' death. And I think one of the main reasons for that is that we don't recognise that we are in desperate, desperate need. There's a problem far bigger than global terrorism, far more pressing than the global debt crisis. And that problem is that the world is evil. It's evil in the sense that we are hostile towards God. Just look at Jesus' own words. I've printed them for you on the handout. They come from John chapter 7, verse 7. Jesus says this: "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify that its works are evil." I want to show you that Jesus' words there have been proved to be correct. They've been demonstrated as correct in his trial we've just had read to us. And so by the end of the talk, I hope we'll be persuaded that there is a desperate, desperate problem, so that when we hear of the solution found in Jesus there, we would see that it has deeply significant implications for us. I wonder if you notice who's really on trial in the passage. You might think it's Jesus, but Jesus actually gets declared innocent, 3 times in fact. Whereas the world here comes off looking completely guilty. And John, who writes the Gospel, wants us to see that this was a complete scandal. He wants to see that the world demonstrated its guilt to persuade us that Jesus is right when he says the world is evil. Now, I guess some of us, if not all of us, will start to feel a bit uncomfortable with that. Perhaps this is one of the first Christian talks you've come to and you've never heard Jesus speak like this. Just to be clear, please don't mishear me. I'm not saying that the whole world is as evil as it could be, or that each of us are equally evil as each other. But having said that, I do think John wants us to feel uncomfortable, because we're all part of this world that has rejected Jesus. And I think that just because it's uncomfortable, we just need to be aware of a couple of the dangers. We could, because it's uncomfortable, we could presuppose that this can't be true. That's a danger. And we can presuppose that it's not as strong as Jesus puts it. We wouldn't want to presuppose in business. If we had some bad news, we would say, you know, although it's not comfortable, let's get it all out on the table. Let's hear it. And then I guess as we hear it, we think there might be a way forward. And if we have that attitude in business, well, how much more should we have that attitude here in these matters? Well, let's begin to have a look at the passage. I've put chapter 1, verses 10 to 11 on your handouts, because I want you to notice there how John categorises humanity. I'll read them to you. "He," that's Jesus, "was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognise him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him." Do you see? The world didn't recognise him, and his own, that's the Jewish people, didn't receive him. And I think that helps us make sense of the content in chapters 18 and 19, because John focuses on these two categories again, so that when we see each group reject Jesus in turn, I think we're to see that as an indication that the whole of humanity rejected Jesus. Well, let's have a look by looking at what's said about Jesus' own people. We're on the first heading on your handouts. a lot has led up to this point in John. In John chapter 6, Jesus came and things were quite positive. Many people believed, so much so that they wanted to make him king by force. But a couple of chapters later, in chapter 8, as Jesus explains more about himself, they end up trying to stone him. And in chapter 11, after Jesus raises his friend Lazarus from the dead, they plot to kill Jesus. And here in chapters 18 and 19, we actually see them go through with it. They hand him over to the Roman governor, Pilate, and you can see that in verse 28. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. They hand him over, and you'll see from the end of verse 31 that they had already made up their minds that Jesus was deserving of execution. A bit later on, Pilate comes out to the crowd. He declares Jesus is innocent. He offers his release. But then verse 40 happens. They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. They chose to have a convicted criminal release instead of Jesus. After Pilate declaring Jesus' innocence twice more, he brings him out in verse 14. It was a day of the preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar. The chief priest answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. It's almost as if the stakes erupt in the passage. To what extent will they go? Will they put up with a convicted criminal on their streets? Give us Barabbas. Will they execute a man without charges? Crucify, crucify. Will they swear allegiance to their hated occupying forces? We have no king but Caesar. And I think John's point here is that these are the very people that should have accepted Jesus. That's the sense in chapter 1, verse 11. If there was any group in humanity who were more inclined to accept Jesus as their king, then it would be Jesus' very own people. The Jewish nation, they had a really rich history. They had... God promised to Abraham, their father, that his descendants would be blessed. God rescued Abraham's descendants, Israel, from slavery in Egypt. He led them through the wilderness, provided food and water for them. God gave Israel his laws, the Ten Commandments and some other laws. God gave them their own land. He promised that one day a wonderful king would come. He would be called the Son of God. Jesus comes as that promised king, but despite all those years of privilege, despite front row seats in God's kingdom, they cry, "Take him away, crucify him." You hear people in the offices say, "If only God gave me a sign, then I'd believe him." Well, Israel had the sign of all signs. They had Jesus. He turned water into wine. He healed the official's son. He cured blindness. He even raised someone from the dead. And here they are shouting, "Crucify him." You hear others say, if God only made himself clearer, then I'd believe. But Israel had Jesus, God's son, with them in the temple, in the synagogues, and yet they cry, "Crucify him." He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Despite all their God-given privilege, that didn't change the orientation of their hearts. Their hearts were set on doing evil might be at this point, your reaction is, yeah, I see what these people did was wrong, but I'd be different. That's my initial reaction. But let's just think about that for a moment. What are we saying there when we think that? Are we saying that in this particular bit of history, people were more evil? Well, that's really quite very, very difficult to argue, isn't it, when we've just come out of the bloodiest century there's ever been. Are we saying that this particular people group is more evil than other people groups? Well, I hope we're not saying that, because we know where that sort of thinking has taken us. No, there is a desperate problem with the world. Something more than signs and revelation can rectify. The world is hostile towards God. The very people to whom God had promised a king cried, "We have no king but Caesar." Well, I want us to move on from the Jewish nation now to look at the rest of the world, who I think are represented by the Romans. We're on the second heading on your handouts. And I don't know if you noticed when Hannah read the passage out, but John doesn't really actually focus on the crowds. He doesn't really focus on Jesus. Jesus only says a couple of things. But instead, the narrative follows Pilate, because I think he wants us to see Pilate's perspective and how he's got a decision to make. And it's not a decision Pilate really wants to make. He's not really bothered. Verse 31. Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." Pilate doesn't really know what's true. It doesn't really think Jesus concerns him, rather. In verse 35, "Am I Jew?" Pilate replied. Verse 38, he doesn't know what's true. He says, "What is truth?" Retorted Pilate. He says those things, but he's given an amazing opportunity to find out about Jesus. I love us to be making the most of the Christianity Explored course here. I think it's a very helpful course for people looking into Christianity. But it's worth saying, if you ever get the chance to do a one-to-one session with Jesus himself, then please go for that instead. That's what Pilate has here. He has a chance to ask Jesus his questions. And after an initial chat, things are quite positive. Verse 38. "What is truth?" Pilate retorted Pilate. "With this he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, 'I find no basis for charge against him.'" But that's not what the crowd wanted to hear. So verse 1. "Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged." Sorry, what? You declare Jesus' innocence, but because of pressure from the crowd, you have him flogged anyway? Imagine if that happened today. There would be complete outrage. I mean, imagine if you or a family member went before a court, you were declared innocent, but because the prosecution stamped their feet a little bit, you got punished anyway. It would be absolutely crazy. Pilate declares Jesus' innocence twice more in verse 4, chapter 19. "Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, 'Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him.'" Verse 6. "As soon as the chief priests and the officials saw him, they shouted, 'Crucify, crucify.' But Pilate answered, 'You take him away and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him.'" But the crowd doesn't back down, and Pilate gets even more afraid. So verse 13. "When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat it down on the judge's seat at the place known as the Stone Pavement, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. 'Here is your king,' Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, 'Take him away, take him away, crucify him.' 'Shall I crucify your king?' Pilate asked. 'We have no king but Caesar,' the chief priests answered." Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. Again, what are you doing, Pilate? There's a man here you know is innocent. You've declared yourself three times publicly, and yet he hands him over to be crucified. There are other non-Jewish people in the passage, the sort of rest of the world camp. They come up in verse 2. And I think in verse 2 we just see the facade of decency lifted as the Roman soldiers exemplify what the world really thinks of having Jesus as their king. I mean, they have God's king in their presence. And what do they do to him? Verse 2. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and they went up to him again and again saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. And John's point here, I think, is that yes, the rest of the world is different to Jesus' own people in the sense that they haven't had God's promises given to them explicitly. But they still have the same heart. They still have that inclination towards evil. When Pilate and the Romans have Jesus in their hands, they reach the same verdict as everyone else. I don't know about you, but I think Pilate really captures the spirit of our age. Lots of people in the city know something about Jesus, but they don't really think he concerns them. They don't really think they know the truth about him. But this passage demonstrates that apathy is not an indication of neutrality. The city might appear to be apathetic, but it's not neutral towards God. We only appear neutral because we've not been forced, like Pilate was, into a life and death decision about Jesus. If you're not convinced by that, I want to ask you how you felt when the passage was read out, when Hannah read it out, and you heard of Pilate's dilemma. How did you feel? Did you feel outraged? Or like me, did you feel a bit of sympathy for Pilate? See, when I read this, I think, well, poor Pilate. I mean, what could he have done? He had this angry mob on his doorstep. He had the danger that his superiors would find out about the civil unrest. And so I started to feel a bit sorry for him. But that sympathy only goes to demonstrate my true allegiance. Our sympathy shows that how light a thing we think it is for Pilate to have Jesus declare himself as God's king, and yet for him to crucify him anyway. It shows how much we value the verdict of the world over the verdict of our Creator. And so my sympathy for Pilate's position demonstrates that I'm not neutral about Jesus, but I'm on the same side as the world, a world that hates Jesus. Seems a long time ago now, doesn't it, that London was transformed for the Olympics. My personal highlight was the opening ceremony, which, if I'm honest, I did get a little bit obsessed with. I ended up watching it 5 times in about a week. If you haven't seen the opening ceremony, don't worry, I've got the DVD. You can borrow it. And I just think about what sort of welcome London gave to the world. You know, all the millions of pounds spent on the ceremony, all the hours of preparation and anticipation. You had the fireworks, you had the big chimneys, you had those flying bicycles, I think, whatever they were. And it was all, you know, amazing. It was spectacular, wasn't it? You know, the nations came to London and a party was thrown. But whereas God's Son came to his world and 6-inch nails were driven through him, God came to earth and we killed him. Well, where does that leave us? Well, before we close, I want to say something about how this should shape our perception of humanity and how it should shape our perception of the world, of God rather. God and the world, if that makes sense. How does it shape our perception of humanity? Well, I think in 21st century Western culture, we don't really believe this. We think we're intrinsically good. And we're probably okay with God if there happens to be one. Whereas Jesus says, no, the world hates him. And so if we don't have Jesus' explanation of reality, if we don't remember that in real history, the world exemplified its hatred towards Jesus in crucifying him, then we're going to be constantly surprised with this world. When you hear that underhand comment about Christianity in the office, when you receive that sharp bit of banter at the after-work drinks, when you want to do wrong in your own heart, I hope you can tell yourself, that's not a surprise, because humanity is hostile towards God. And if we don't have Jesus' perspective on the world, I think it's going to give us a sort of lopsided gospel. A gospel with a solution, but with a very small problem it's trying to solve. See, if we think we're just half okay, that God just had to iron out a few creases in our morality, then we're going to have a very, very shallow view of Jesus. Whereas if we're conscious of the problem, then we're going to be in desperate need for the solution. We're going to be thinking that is the only hope for us, and it's the only hope for those of us in our offices. What about our perception of God? Well, I actually want to commend this truth to you. I know it's not a comfortable one, but I think it's a liberating truth. John tells us earlier in 2 verse 25, it's on your handouts there, he says this about Jesus. See, Jesus did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. Fascinating verse that, isn't it? Jesus knows what's in each person. He looks at us, just as we look into a shop window, and he can see what's in us. He can see what's in our hearts. I mean, just consider that for a moment. Jesus could look into the people that were putting him on trial, and he knew their intentions, and yet he's still here choosing to die to save them. We haven't said much about the solution this week. You can hear about it on the talk last week. It's on the website, and we're going to hear more about it next week in the Easter service. But just the fact that Jesus is up here on trial, obediently providing that solution, when he knows what's in us, when he knows what's in a man, when he knows what the world is like, that just blows me away. I said it's a liberating truth, because the news of Jesus is not about pretending we're better than we are. It's not about saying we're half okay when we're not. But it is about God, who knows exactly what we're like, tells us what we're like, but still loves the world so much that he gives his one and only Son. Let's pray. Our Father, we recognize these words are not comfortable. We don't like thinking of them about ourselves. We don't like thinking of them and what that means for the world. But we do praise you, our Father, that you still looked at us, seeing us like this, and chose to send your Son into the world. So please, our Father, would you write these truths on our heart? Would you convict us of them? Would that lead us to not sort of underplay the problem, but to get it out on the table? And would that cause us, our Father, to have a much deeper appreciation of what Jesus is doing here? In his name we pray. Amen.